That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Now, you want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
We're after circulation. What we need is fireworks. People are going to hit with sledgehammers. Stir arguments.
Oh, I can do that. I know this town inside out.
That's what we're going to do. Take a look at this town inside out. Today on The Week in Review, I'm Steve Scherr. Thanks for tuning in with us. The Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. Joni Balter is a news analyst. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Knut Berger is the Mossback at Crosscut.com. He has a column at Seattle Magazine, author of Pugetopolis, among other books. Sir?
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Sir?
Sir. Nice to see
you.
Oh,
we're sirring it today.
We are sirring it today. Well, because we're thinking, you know, people were saying, boy, isn't this going to be somber to talk about Nelson Mandela and his legacy? I thought, no, it's not a somber occasion at all, is it? It's an occasion for reflection, but
I have a rule about that. If somebody lives to 95 or 96, that's the full ride, you know?
So you
kind of have to celebrate that for that much long living and inspiration to a whole world.
I think what's also
pretty darn amazing.
It is. And what's also been interesting is to reread the history of the times. Because, I mean, I'm you guys, right? We in the 70s, the 80s, the anti-apartheid movement, the disinvestment movement was very strong in the Northwest. And it was part of what we covered, right? I remember people protesting at the UW on the disinvestment campaign. That was a big issue.
I remember in the 1960s, this would be like the mid-1960s, they actually were show. I went to Asa Mercer Junior High, which is up on Beacon Hill, large minority population, you know, inner city school. They were showing us documentaries about the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, these old, like, black and white newsreels about it back then when it was all happening.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember that, too.
Well, just a different take. I saw a post from Ron Judd from the Seattle Times who said that his students, you know, were trying to grasp the death. And to them, this is interesting because we all remember his 27 years in prison. But to these students, he'd been free their whole lives, which is sort of a different focus on it.
For me, he was freed when I was 13 years old. He was imprisoned 15 years before I was born. So I do have somewhat of a different perspective, I think, than the people who lived through his imprisonment. And yet what's amazing, at the same time, you can be born after he was imprisoned or after he was freed and know his story and know what he stood for very, very well. And I think, obviously, that's a testament to the impact he had on minds around the world.
Well, forgive this moment of name dropping, but I actually met Nelson Mandela years ago when he came to Seattle. It was the old Gates Foundation, the one in that building you couldn't tell was anything. And so the members of the editorial board got to go sit down for an hour with him and talk. And I remember, I mean, I'm sure I said something there, but I remember being so starstruck and so taken with this quiet, dignified, gracious man. I was so taken with that. I could hardly offer up some comments or questions or any of it.
You know, we were thinking that you folks have got some experience with this and maybe you'd like to share it with us, especially if you were involved in the divestment movement, if you were involved in the anti-apartheid movement and what Mandela meant to you. I'd like to read some of your emails, read some of your tweets. You can tweet us. You can put a hashtag, review this. Which I thought was going to be an isolated hashtag that would be a good idea and nobody else was using it. Turns out hashtag review this. Other people use it for other things.
A lot of authors, potentially.
In anger.
Ooh, that kind of review.
So for today, we'll keep using hashtag review this and share with us what you remember about that movement and that time and how Nelson Mandela's passing has you reflecting. Also, you can email us, weekinreview@kuow.org. We'd like to hear from you, weekinreview@kuow.org. I mean, a lot of folks are bringing out their stories. A lot of folks had their stories written. You and I were talking about the Bill Keller obituary in the New York Times that had the whole history of the man's life. There's so many interesting things to think about how he how he shaped himself and then how that influenced other people.
Well, just to refer to that Bill Keller piece in the New York Times, he mentioned that he started writing it in 2007. And so it's three pages. It goes on. It's his entire life. And yes, I felt that I did need a review to remember everything about this man.
Yeah. But it was good to see all that. I thought one of the interesting things was that the idea that he had been raised in a house of royalty, and that influenced the way he worked with people.
So the manners that came with that, instead of being the angry person who'd been imprisoned for too long, you sort of follow that through that whole story.
Yeah.
About how somehow that grace and those manners had been taught very early on.
He was a politician. That was the other thing that was interesting. He was a politician that made his choices as the politics changed, and he knew what he had to do to follow his strategy. I thought that was interesting. The other thing that I thought was interesting then was that he was, and again, it was in this Keller piece and somewhere else, the younger activists were getting arrested in the 80s, and they would come, and here'd be Mandela already in prison for so long, and they'd say, you know, we're going to fight them, we're going to take it over, we're going to attack, 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 and already by then Mandela was saying, all right, have you assessed the strength of your opponents? Have you assessed how they're going to react? What's your response going to be? And
he was really schooling them the whole time, because he'd had all that time to think about which was the best way to present the argument that he had. He was really schooling them.
One word that stood out for me in the Keller obituary was forbearance. I mean,
exactly.
The forbearance to sit in prison for 27 years and not be destroyed by that, and to come out with clarity about what you wanted to do with the rest of your life, and this calm and humility at the same time as determination to see through what you were working on. I mean, that is something that I can't think of someone alive right now who has demonstrated anything close to that.
Yeah, that Eli makes a point that I wanted to make too about that. It's very difficult to imagine anybody living of the stature, the accomplishment, the kind of, and you know, for Americans, you would have to, and this isn't an exact parallel, but you'd almost have to combine George Washington, Martin Luther King, maybe Abraham Lincoln, you know, into one person to think about the kind of level of stature, accomplishment, respect, not just as as somebody who helped to found a country or renew it in a very significant way. And I think that also that element of being both a fighter, literally he was a boxer, among
yeah.
other things.
Wasn't that interesting?
Which reminded me of that book, The Power of One, which was about boxing in South Africa. Yeah.
So, you know, literally a fighter. But that one of the amazing things is that legacy of reconciliation. To me, that's the thing that gives me the sort of goosebumps, is how easy it is for so many countries that go through this to fall into perpetual generational habits of retribution. And it's just an amazing thing. And it's a work in progress. It's a constant thing. It's not like it's ever finished.
Right.
Well,
but it's an amazing direction.
What's interesting to me is that nobody ever interpreted his quiet and his forbearance as weak. It was always quiet power, and because they knew there was so much packed into that sort of dignity that he brought to each of these situations. I mean, I wrote down one of the quotes in the Keller thing. I said, "This is his MLK moment." It's where he's bringing white and black South Africa together and saying that we all have to change.
Let me play you a clip from President Obama, Eli, first, then I want you to weigh in. This is what President Obama said after Mandela's passing.
I am one of the countless millions who drew inspiration from Nelson Mandela's life. My very first political action, the first thing I ever did that involved an issue or a policy or politics, was a protest against apartheid. I would study his words and his writings. The day he was released from prison, gave me a sense of what human beings can do when they're guided by their hopes and not by their fears. And like so many around the globe, I cannot fully imagine my own life without the example that Nelson Mandela set. And so long as I live, I will do what I can to learn from him.
That's President Obama. We're thinking about the legacy of Nelson Mandela. If you would share it with us, what's your thoughts about his legacy or your remembrance of how he brought you into politics? Maybe you were part of the divestment campaigns in the 70s and 80s in Washington State. Use a hashtag review this if you're on Twitter. Hashtag review this and tell us your thoughts. Also, you can email us weekinreview@kuow.org.
Just to add to the comparisons that were being drawn, Knut listed a number of American comparisons. I think we also have to draw in Gandhi. He obviously learned from the lessons of Gandhi and has been compared to him a lot. And you just think about, and I'm probably going to butcher the phrase that Gandhi used, but, you know, first they ignore you, then they fight you, then you win.
Yeah, that's interesting. He was saying that. Well, actually, hold that thought in mind because you'll hear this in a clip play going out of this segment. Also that, you know, a reminder again of where Gandhi came from, right? Gandhi was part of that movement of liberation movement in South Africa, and he was probably drawing inspiration from that as well. It is interesting, though, that I think maybe this was in the Keller piece. It was in some other New York Times pieces. I thought I also read it in the Guardian piece that though the rest of the world comes to see him as this symbol of liberation and power and enlightenment, people in South Africa were more than happy to also recognize that he was a politician who made political decisions, made some people mad, made a lot of people mad with his reconciliation. And you know, he was a politico.
Well, what I heard also this morning, I believe it was on NPR, was that, you know, South Africa is still torn in many ways. It's not like the work was done and now everybody's healed. Not one, you know, not at all. It's a work in progress.
Yeah. Yeah, and it remains a work in progress. I guess that's what a work in progress is, that it remains so. in terms of that divestment campaign, I would be really curious to hear from people who worked on it, because I remember when the university was fighting back against that in the 80s, and many corporations were, many institutions were, and the university was one of them, the University of Washington, did not want to make the connection, or did not think that would be a useful effort.
It was too political for them to do. They were just doing, you know, business, shall we say?
Right.
They didn't like
it's business.
They didn't like the idea of. You mean each of these investments has meaning, you know, or sends a message?
that idea of. Excuse me, socially responsible investments in some ways started with Vietnam, but I think the anti-apartheid movement really took that to a broader level. And there, you know, people supported economic sanctions, a lot of people did, and that making people re-look at their portfolios, including public institutions, the state, the university, and others, and saying, you know, this isn't just about dollars and cents. This is about the morality of the companies that you're giving money to.
I know Paul, John Hockenberry just talked about this on The Takeaway, but the other interesting thing, because it's parallel to that, was what rock musicians did and what musicians did, either in not playing Sun City or playing Sun City in a way that was a political act, Paul Simon going with Graceland, Johnny Clegg establishing a band. And I mean, they were using his sort of ideas out in the sphere, even when he was still imprisoned.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very...
Paul Simon was very active in South Africa.
And got a lot of criticism for it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For bringing those people in. All right.
And some good music came out of that.
And some good music. Yeah, we heard some already. Township music came out of that whole era as well. All right, we'll take a break. I'd like to read some of your thoughts. So weekinreview@kuow.org. You have some thoughts about Mandela's passing. Like you to share them with us, weekinreview@kuow.org, or you can use the Twitter and put a hashtag, review this, Here's the BBC put together a whole montage of Mandela speaking and talking, but to Eli's earlier point about how people were inspired and how they listened to sort of that Gandhian notion too. Here's Mandela speaking about that.
we had the feeling that we had been victorious and that the people who actually were the accused were the government itself. And that kept us very much alive. And then when we noticed that the ideas for which we had committed our lives were still very much alive, even though we're in jail, we also got a lot of strength as a result.
If you would share your thoughts about Nelson Mandela and the divestment movement, the anti-apartheid movement, how it affected you here in the Northwest or wherever you were, weekinreview@kuow.org. You can also use Twitter, use the hashtag #ReviewThis. I'd like to read some of your thoughts to some of the other folks who are thinking about this, Nelson Mandela's passing. We'll move on to some other topics as well, but looking for your emails, and I will read them as they come in. Yesterday, the National Urban League's head, Mark Morial, came to town, and we did an interview with him on the record. And he was mayor of New Orleans when they had a consent decree, and they were under the same sort of restrictions that the SPD is under, and the Seattle is under as well. And I asked him about, I wanted his opinion on this notion that one of the assistant chiefs, Nick Metz, was demoted. And he said, you know, I don't know the particulars, but one thing I do know is that when I was elected mayor, I called up the guy who was still in office, my predecessor, and I said, please do not make any personnel changes, and do not sign any contracts, and do not make any big decisions in the 2 months before I take office. And with that, and of course, you know, whether somebody's going to comply with that or not is a different question. But with that in mind, the SPD and the whole question of what's happening with leadership is going to remain the hot topic for Ed Murray. So I start with you, Knut. What should Ed Murray be doing when he reads in the paper, oh, Nick Metz has been demoted?
Well, you can't. I mean, the SPD has been criticized for not moving fast enough by the Monitor. So you can't take 2 months and just set it aside, not do anything. The feds want progress. The citizens of Seattle want some progress. So decisions are going to have to be made. And you have to, if you're in that job, if you're in the chief's job, you have to act as if you're going to continue to be in that job. You can't simply turn yourself into a lame duck. You have to at least behave as if you are not. Otherwise, you just won't be effective at all. And if that is uncomfortable for the incoming mayor or anybody else, that's tough. However, people aren't standing still. I mean, you have the city council is now, you know, looking at this rule that prevents the chief from hiring and firing top deputies. And so they're trying to change some of the rules of the game so that whoever is chief or becomes chief will have a freer hand to affect cultural change by hiring his own team of top people.
What's the history of that rule?
Well, yeah, I just know what I read in the Seattle Times, so I don't really know much about it. Tim Burgess, who city councilman, former policeman, said that it's really unclear what the history was.
It went back to the 70s, is what I read, but there wasn't a clear explanation of how it came up. But we were coming out of the police corruption things,
police corruption scandals. Maybe it was a trade-off that happened when they were cleaning the department. Some concessions were made to give people remaining some security or whatever. I really don't know what the history is. I never knew that rule existed, but certainly in most private sector situations, when you bring in a new person, you expect that person is going to surround themselves with at least, you know, some people that they can bring in so that they can affect the change.
And the effect of the rule is to reinforce the culture that already exists in the department, because the rule as it stands. Right. Anyone who comes to have power in the department is from within the department. And so obviously, if you were trying to change the culture, this would be a good place to start.
Well, Earth to the new mayor, the transition time is always, I always think it's like a free-for-all this time period, because it's, you know, the new mayor's quietly, he's at mayor school at Harvard or something, and so he's not really in control. The outgoing mayor's a little distracted thinking about what he might do next. And so stuff happens during transition time, and we're all focused on Thanksgiving and Christmas. I mean, it's wild in some ways. But the Earth to the new mayor is that the interim chief, Jim Pugel, wants the job. Hence this quote. In the past, some leaders in this department have faced criticism for failing to make difficult decisions. Well, guess what that means? He's not going to be living with that criticism, because he's going to make the difficult decisions. And it has been known for some number of years that while this Department of Justice thing is going on, that, and they always use this phrase, the command staff, unclear exactly who that was the problem. Senior command staff, I think, is how they phrased it. And so this is something that has had to be dealt with. And I think what Jim Pugel is saying is, hey, look at me. I would like the job, and I will make the tough decisions. Boom.
You know, we're I heard that apparently a new coach for the Husky football team has been hired. And can you imagine hiring a football coach, somebody to take over a program, and telling them they couldn't fire any of their assistant coaches?
You mean because they fire all of them?
Well, you know, I mean, what?
Usually when a leader comes
when
in,
when a guy comes in, he gets to pick his own coaches. And that happens. And so, you know, why should the UW football team have more, you know, freedom of operation than something even more consequential like the police department?
Yeah. And it is true about Pugel, isn't it? He is making that statement. And I mean, even the action with Nick Metz, though activists like Harriet Walden said this was a slap in the face to the African-American community, Pugel's argument was, I'm making changes because of what the Monitor has told us.
And he's running hard for this position. I mean, this is effectively a political campaign for him, and he doesn't want there to be any room for him to be seen as part of the problem, part of the old guard, part of the house that needs to be cleaned. He's going to get out there and start cleaning house to give Ed Murray every opportunity to say, you know what, we've got a reformer already in the chief's chair, and I'm going to stick with him.
He's the guy with the bucket and the mop. You know, I'm willing to, ready to clean. Let's go.
Yeah.
You know.
How do you think that plays with that? Ed Murray was pretty, what would be a fair way to characterize it, diffident about the idea of keeping Jim Pugel?
Well, here's the thing. So they are going to do a national search. There's no way where we are right now that there wouldn't be a national search. But as we've said on this show before, it is difficult to get a big group of finalists who are willing to have their names made public, because that usually they work for some other department, and that's seen as disloyal. And so you're looking for a reform-minded, somebody who can work big city, and somebody who can work in a diverse community. It ends up being a smaller list than you would think. And so Jim Pugel will probably be in a group of four or five. I'm just imagining that. And so, you know, they have to do the national search, but what we don't know is what's been said to Pugel behind the scenes, like, you know, please apply, you're in there, you have a good chance. It seems to me like he's in the running along with whoever else shows up.
Well, during the campaign, one of the points of difference between that drawn between Mike McGinn and Ed Murray was Murray emphasized wanting a national search and wanting a new candidate, new candidates who could transform the culture. The heavy implication of what he was saying at the very least was he wanted to go outside the department. While McGinn was backing Pugel as certainly you know, potentially continuing in that job. So it seems to me clear that the Murray bias is toward that national search,
well,
toward getting an outsider, toward getting somebody who's going to bring a real fresh.
Well, consider what happened,
and experience.
Though. McGinn led the way when he, you know, he did his own national search, and he ended up with John Diaz. But he had been wooing the guy from Sacramento, and the guy from Sacramento is the one who cut out. There were only three finalists that time, and he cut out, and that left John Diaz as our chief. But McGinn at that time did not favor John Diaz first. He favored, what's his name, Somebody help.
The guy from Sacramento.
The guy from Sacramento is his new name. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's fair because where you might end up in sort of a default position. But Murray did say during the campaign he wanted somebody who had experience transforming a department in this way. And that clearly Pugel's, implies not Pugel.
No, but Pugel's now transforming. What about
or trying
that?
To.
Well,
trying
yeah, to. He's
showing he has the guts to
right,
go into the senior command staff, make change.
This is his audition.
I wonder whether we will see, speaking of auditions, something similar to what McGinn did when he was looking for police chiefs, where they come to town one after another, they meet the media briefly, they meet the council. I mean, that will be a very different moment than the one we have now, where there's this theoretical prospect of looking around the country and there's a very loud police chief saying, hey, look at me.
And don't forget, the incoming council president is probably going to be Tim Burgess. And he, you know, he knows policing and he's very smart about it and he talks about it a lot. And he's going to have a big role to play here. It's not just going to be a mayoral appointment and a council that just goes, sure, whatever.
So I know we are four white people talking about this. And so I would like, and if people want to weigh in on it, I would be curious as well. But one thing I thought it was interesting that Harriet Walden, who's been an activist, is one of the people who's been pushing for reform of the police department for years, said that the demotion of Nick Metz as one of the assistant chiefs from one of the assistant chiefs, he's been the face of the department. She said, and she provided a news release. She gave examples of where Metz had been part of the community, and she said his demotion infers that the problem is the black guy. Now, when Mark Morio was here, that was one of the things he said. Well, you know, I don't know, and I don't know how we should talk about this, but I'm not. Does it help to make this part of the conversation? Because it is part of the conversation.
Well, it's already part of the conversation, and so for the black community, you can understand they had somebody they felt was from their community, somebody they could relate to, and he was very high up in the department. But we also had a chief until last May who was Hispanic. So it's not just one topic there, but I do understand that the community feels that was somebody they could connect to, and now he's not in that position. He's back to captain.
You know, the other thing I was curious about is, you mentioned this, what does the council do now?
Oh, well, what do they do now? You mean
in terms of responding
to the situation?
Time, yeah.
Oh, well, they organize themselves and they elect a president. They usually do that like the last couple weeks of December, and then that person shows up in January. I saw Sally Clark this week and was talking to her. She didn't seem to mind not being the council president, after her 2 years. So only a few people do 4 years, and she was fine with the 2-year stint. So the word is it's going to be Burgess, but then they assign themselves to these committees. And believe me, public safety will be the hot one to be, you know, who's going to do that, because they have sort of extra vetting of candidates and that kind of thing.
Has Bruce Harrell done public safety before?
I believe he's the public safety
right now. Right now.
And he may ask for four years on that, or however many years.
And that's another thing that's happening, by the way, on the council, the assigning of committee chairs as they also move forward to picking a president. And one of the minor intrigues in the context of everything else going on in the city is which chair, if any, Shama Sawant will get.
Will she sit in a chair is what he's getting at. She wants to stand.
But if any, doesn't everybody get it?
Well,
yes,
there was a rumor floating around that if the council viewed her as enough of a threat or someone that they could not work with, they could keep her off any committee, potentially.
That's a terrible idea.
That doesn't sound like a terrible idea. Council.
You have to understand. So you know what's often open at this point is land use. You do not give a fresh person land use. It's a way of sinking them. It's a very hard committee. It's not for everybody.
Sally Clark had that.
Right. There's several committees. I mean, there are a number of committees that are really hard. Utilities, another one that isn't exactly one that people leap at because it's complicated and difficult. One of the interesting things, this actually just changing the discussion a little bit, is looking ahead at 2 years. The committee structure is probably going to have to change under the district elections, because you'll be in an awkward position if you have one neighborhood in charge of land
parks.
In other words, or parks.
Yeah.
In other words, a lot of these committees are citywide, and so there's talk right now about how the committee structures might or be shifted around. Some committees might be combined. You may have committees of the whole. There might be a number of juggling around because you'll only have essentially two citywide representatives on the city council and everybody in this more kind of parochial role. So we're going to see, I think, a lot of change over the next couple of years, and though I'm not sure what we'll see in the short term.
But Shama Sawant deserves the respect of a committee and the chance to fit in and all of that, and the council is going to do that. There's no way they wouldn't give her committee.
Let me read you a couple of emails before we take the break, from since I asked you folks to share your thoughts about Nelson Mandela and your memories of the era when he was in prison. And Cornbread wrote, "To survive the brutal fight against apartheid, 27 years imprisonment as a political prisoner, and emerge without a trace of hate in his heart is remarkable. All he wanted was reconciliation to make the world and his country a better place, and he did. Incredible. If a greater man has walked the earth, I don't know who it is. I was watching my 12-year-old nephew yesterday, and I greatly enjoyed being able to educate him on this great man." And then Nick writes, "I'm celebrating the life of Madiba today. He saved my homeland of South Africa from itself. He saved all of us from our worst instincts and the consequences of giving into those. I left in 1983 on my 21st birthday, believing that there was another 20 years or more of brutal white domination. I thought Mandela would die in prison. I never imagined that he would be released, let alone emerged as an amazing, inspirational leader. He really was the only person who could have held the country together at that fragile point. With his grace, humor, humility, compassion, determined strength, he led a severely damaged people and land through a time that could have ended in savagery. I'm pleased he found personal happiness through his late-in-life marriage to Grace Michelle and was able to retire from public life near the end. No one ever deserved a rest more than Madiba. Now he rests in peace, leaving memories and inspiration for the world." A few more of your emails about Nelson Mandela. "I believe apartheid rhymes with hate. I was a radio programmer at Cugs and presented shows against the apartheid regime in South Africa and the whole range of oppression around the world and in the U.S. I was overjoyed when he was freed and followed his progress ever since. His release and the fall of apartheid seemed as important as the fall of the Berlin Wall later." And Regina writes, for this moment when we can celebrate Mandela's full long life and legacy and not be mourning an assassin's bullet as with so many other visionary leaders is something to think about. And then a little bit on the divestment movement. "I was involved in student activism," Graham writes, "in the 80s in South Africa. From the inside, we didn't feel the divestment was always helpful other than being symbolic. In some ways, it made the poor poorer. Instead, what broke apartheid government economically were the trade unions under the umbrella of the United Democratic Front, the internal wing of the ANC. In addition, the military strength of the government was undermined both by the anti-conscription movement, the End Conscription Campaign, and by the strengthening of external opposition through the support of Cuba. While the apartheid government was often getting covert military support from the CIA under the guise of anti-communism. It's interesting to note, too, that the power struggles that happened in the ANC after Mandela were often between those who fought from inside and those who fought from outside, the exiles. And, David, I participated in the anti-apartheid efforts, boycotting Seafirst Bank. What I remember is a disagreement among activists, even opposite ideas between different organizations as we opposed apartheid. I witnessed an ANC rep refer to some popular leaders of the African-American community as crazy. Mandela had a way of thinking, verified by today's brain-mind science, of patience with people and looking at problems and differences as challenges to embrace and love for what we can learn to overcome so we can grow and change. Mandela just extended that view to those many of us would call the opposition or even enemies. However simple, effective, logical that may be, this way of thinking has always been a challenge for people throughout history." All right. Oh, Hans. Hans said Cornbread was one of his old black labs, and that's where the email came from. I read an email from Cornbread. I didn't know the black labs were sending emails, but that's good. Hans, thanks for that. So Hans sent that email. All right, let me turn to some other news of our area. the election's over. We got to look at some maps. Seattle Times had some maps about where Murray ran strong, where Mike McGinn ran strong, where Sawant ran strong, where Richard Conlon did not run as strong. What did you make of those maps?
Well, two things. Anytime anything can be compared to a bagel is a pretty good time. Was that the stranger that came up with that?
Mm-hmm.
So the ends are crusty and older, the edges of the bagel. And this. Well, anyway, I'll stop with the bagel until somebody offers
gives
some
you
cream,
some schmear, yeah.
Some schmear or something like that. I actually thought that some of this was a little off, some of these comparisons. And the reason I think so is you have to go along with this premise, you have to buy the idea, which I don't, that Ed Murray is some sort of a conservative. Hello, folks. He is the first gay mayor of Seattle. And
well, he can be a conservative.
Yes, he might. He might be, but he's sort of an activist who helped legalize gay marriage. And I just don't see him as, you know, high. He's the conservative. I mean, people have tried to make that argument because he had ties to, you know, downtown and things like that. But I just don't think it worked.
Well, conservative versus liberal is the wrong way of looking at the map. All of Seattle is liberal. What you're seeing on the map is a class divide. You see the poorer neighborhoods or the less wealthy neighborhoods, you know, everything from poor to middle class shaded in the colors that voted for McGinn and Shama Sawant. And you see the upper middle class and upper class neighborhoods voting for what we would sometimes call more conservative, but really it's the continuance of business interests in the city, certain business interests. And, you know, the candidate who is backed by the Downtown Seattle Association, say.
It's even more complicated than that when you look at the map. One of the things I've been doing is looking at the new district system and then how the districts voted. Some of Sawant's,
you're overlaying a different map.
Yeah.
He's using the district elections map to do it. That's interesting.
And here's what you find. So you would think Sawant would do really well in the third district, which is Capitol Hill, First Hill. That she did. Second district did great. She also did really well in the sixth district, North End. It's also interestingly the sixth district from a median income standpoint is the wealthiest district in Seattle.
Now,
it has the largest household median income, believe it or not. That's Green Lake, Ballard, Fremont. And so it's interesting because it cuts against the idea that it's a strictly a class thing.
That's
and,
what I was thinking.
Yeah. And
I think it's way more complicated.
It is way more complicated. And then you also can see some of the kinds of ways in which some of the areas of Seattle are liberal on some things, most things, but a little more reluctant when it comes to property taxes or a little more reluctant when it comes to other kinds of reform and whatnot. So I think the map is complicated, but the bagel or what it used to be called the donut, you know, the donut effect, with all those waterfront neighborhoods.
No trans fats now.
You know, yeah, that's right. No trans fats. But that does always leap out as you see that the some of those, you know, wealthier Lakeshore and Puget Sound Shore neighborhoods are a little more conservative.
Although the neighborhood that you're using as the kind of counterexample here, Fremont, is a unique situation in Seattle, home of the Statue of Lenin, home of one of the highest concentrations of extremely liberal and extremely wealthy residents that you could find.
Yeah, I'm just saying that you can have an affluent North End neighborhood that was still strongly Sawant. It isn't just poor single renters.
I mean, I'm afraid that this is just too simplistic, and that's I'm glad we're getting
because,
to that.
Because it's maybe layers you could say, on layers.
No, because maybe you could say it's communities that are closer to Sound Transit, and what does that mean? I mean, it just gets a little silly. So,
I'm just being
difficult.
That's
today,
good. You should be. What does that mean for who runs in 2 years?
Well,
I mean, what's the message?
Well, the good
for
news for Sawant was she's got the third district election district nailed. But it, you know, we have 2 years to go. The voters have proven to be increasingly fickle. If you got to get in there and do things, seems like she's fine for the third district. Don't forget, some of the current council members are going to run for the two at large seats, and there must be some sort of land grab going on for that real estate right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think if someone can build on what she's got, she has a shot at a citywide race, I think, an open seat. I think it would be premature to view her as, she's the shoe-in for the third district or something. I think she has the potential to run citywide. I think she did extremely well citywide, obviously, and that may be a better place for her.
Why?
Because of the issues that she advocates, which are citywide issues that have to do with income inequality. That isn't just a neighborhood issue or whatever. So progressives could get potentially a citywide candidate like Sawant elected, and then also have a very strong supporter of that person by getting a new third district, representative. On the council,
we'll see that
teaming up maybe with O'Brien or whatever. I mean, you could have, I think, she will want to build, I would imagine, her coalition on the council, and there's an opportunity to do that as opposed to just looking at the district level.
Well, to me, it seems like some of the others will, you know, you'll see this sort itself out pretty soon, because they're going to clear out all the accounts of, you know, that exist, and you'll see people starting to line up before you know it for those at large. So we'll see who chimes in there.
It is going to be an interesting shift in the political dynamic, won't it, when people have to think about council districts and alliances with mayors. They will come across differently.
And broad topic committees.
Yeah.
Don't forget, so as we said earlier, broad topic committee. So if you're public safety, is that just for your district or
yeah.
citywide?
Well, I've been saying too that this is a huge opportunity and challenge, but mainly opportunity, I think, for Ed Murray, because he can begin to restructure city government to work with the district system. In other words, there are things that he can do with the Department of Neighborhoods or with the way decisions are made at DPD and whatnot that will recognize a different reality a couple of years down the road. And he has a chance to do that early on, I think.
Well, one of the unifying factors, for better or worse, for the council in previous years, one of the unifying factors was this sort of, we don't like the mayor. But so the council, I think, just with this, with the dynamic of everyone trying to sort out who's going to run for the at large, and the fact that they all sort of like this mayor, since many of them endorsed him, is going to be. I think the council now will be more fractured than it was in the.
That'll be interesting. So one of the things that they're going to deal with, and one of the things we're seeing from Sawant's success is also the rise of the $15 minimum wage. Now it's across the country. People are paying attention to it. The federal government's thinking about a rise in the minimum wage, though not to $15. A lot of pros and cons about how it affects the economy. I saw some great pieces in New York Times that argued that there are you could come up with many benefits for what it means to raise the minimum wage, and then the economists, of course, will debate that. But how's it going to we see it's going to shape politics here, and it may shape policy. And I'm curious about the policy. Do you think Ed Murray said he would support it? What can he do? What does he do next?
I think he supports it harder than he's supported it in the past. He's basically paid lip service to it, as far as I can tell, but. Now you have someone who's demonstrated that there is strong support citywide for someone really pushing hard on that idea. We saw the march yesterday where people walked 15 miles for the $15 minimum wage to City Hall. And so hopefully Ed Murray helps make this happen. If he can be seen as the mayor who makes this happen in Seattle, that would be great. There's also this push, by the way, to have voters just vote on it, which would bypass both the council and the mayor.
And didn't I read that they're going to do a council study on it so that it delays it at least till, like, I think June? And so it'll take a minute here unless there's a citizens initiative, which is not that hard to do in a city. It's this low number of signatures. So you can just roll that way.
Yeah, I honestly think the question will be when, and is it phased in, and if so, how is it phased in? I think even people – I was talking to an economist this weekend who was saying he's absolutely for the $15 an hour minimum wage. He was citing some of the potential negative benefits it could have if you do it suddenly. And looking at maybe kind of working it in and graduated over a couple of years or a few years. And I think that's where some of the debate will be. Are we postponing it for political purposes, or is there a genuine common sense argument for doing it in stages?
Well, even Obama chimed in this week. I mean, definitely folks are paying attention to this nationwide. Obama talked about that, and as you know, California is raising its minimum wage. They're going to leapfrog past us in 2 years. So, again, phased in. So there's a lot of talk nationwide about this. It's very much caught on.
Well, President Obama hooked it to the idea of the inequality and the growing inequality. And a number of people were citing a study from Alliance for a Just Society, you can tell that they probably even sound like a left-leaning think tank. But they said a single adult in Washington State would need to earn $16 an hour, $16.04 an hour, 40 hours a week in order to balance the most basic household budget. Do Democrats try to run on this in 2 years in sort of response to what will be government doesn't work, Obama destroyed the economy with Obamacare?
You mean Democrats in the 2014 congressional races?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean? I think
in the state and around the country.
It absolutely could be. You know, and there was a New Yorker piece that talked about that the Occupy movement has sort of blended into this, and there, you know, that we always think that the harsh edge of the political spectrum is the Tea Party, but there is a left part to that as well that may emerge.
And I don't think you'll see Democrats running on a $16 an hour minimum wage, but $12 is what we're talking about nationally, and that polls well in both parties. So I don't see the downside. I actually don't see why Republicans aren't embracing it, but of course it's anathema to a lot of them, and the Tea Party is very opposed to this. And so I think you will see Democrats getting some very strong traction by raising this, even if it doesn't succeed. The other thing that I think is helpful when we're talking about these things is to multiply them out. So a lot of people think in annual incomes rather than hourly wages. And so $16 an hour, if I was just doing it right here on the calculator, just about $33,000 a year. So it sounds high relative to what you're used to hearing of as an hourly wage that people will accept. But if you think in annual incomes, it's not very high.
But also there could be this moment where the SeaTac minimum wage is being challenged in court. It's only ahead, 77 votes or something like that? We've seen elections turn on recounts.
All right, let me just end with a short letter here, one more short letter. It's from David Barash about memories of Nelson Mandela. After World War II, it seemed that every Frenchman was a member of the anti-Nazi resistance, whereas we know that there were many, many collaborators. Now with Mandela's death, it sounds as though all Americans supported him. Not so. There was no mention about how President Ronald Reagan and conservative Republicans supported apartheid in South Africa, opposed Mandela being freed. The Anti-Apartheid Act of 1986 was opposed by Jesse Helms, Strom Thurmond, Phil Graham, Dick Cheney. Strongly supported apartheid, objected to the freeing of Mandela. Mr. Mandela has been duly acclaimed for his lack of bitterness, yet he also emphasized the importance of accurate memory, which is what we've been doing, trying to have some accurate memories.
That's a good reminder.
It is. Knute Berger is author of Pugetopolis, writes for Crosscut. Eli Sanders writes for The Stranger. Joni Balter is a news analyst. We shall speak again next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Jason Pagano is the producer of The Week in Review. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. This is The Week in Review from KUOW Seattle.